So, in the last lecture, we talked a little bit about the notion of entanglement and how we understand entanglement. Entanglement is understood as the ignorance that you gain about one subsystem when you eliminate all the information about another. Right? That was our working definition of entanglement from an informational point of view. How much extra mixedness you get in your subsystem was not there before because you erased information about another subsystem. That's how we understand entanglement. It's certainly one way we do not understand entanglement is by saying, oh, by measuring one system, I gain information about another, because that's the notion of correlations that exists classically as well, as we discussed. Make sense? All right. So today, one of the things that we're going to do today is go through the EPR argument a little bit before starting with this. So when in the times of the height of the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics, which we have, who would you put in the field of the Copenhagen interpretation? Well, Niels Bohr, obviously, and Erwin Schrödinger, and other people like that, that were discussing already in the Solvay conferences, and we're talking in the early 30s, we're discussing about the fact that, in principle, states that have this property, that if you, every individual state, individually, you will not be able to tell the outcome of a measurement. If you measure one first, seems like you are going to force, in a way, the outcome of the second. That interpretation of collapse of the wave function that comes from the Copenhagen interpretation, together with the fact that there are states that are entangled. And the states that are entangled are not very weird. I mean, you can think of, even a single state in a hydrogen atom is a state that has entanglement already. So those things were there, and they were discussing it. And there were several people that strongly objected to those states being a really good physical representation of physical reality. And Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen wrote a paper summarizing the... Einstein didn't really like quantum mechanics for several reasons. One of them being this. This is one of the reasons he didn't like it too much. The fact that it seems that there's something weird about the probabilistic nature of quantum mechanics, and there's something weird about the way that you update a state after a measurement. Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen, typically people know Einstein, obviously. People typically know Rosen as well, a little bit more than Podolsky. I recommend that if you don't know Podolsky, you read about him. He's pretty cool. Podolsky was pretty cool. Also was a Soviet spy in the US. And he was asked once why he did it in an interview. And he said, did you do it for money? No, did you do it for idealism or, you know, like, was your family threatened or something? There, he said, no, I did it for the money. He was very matter-of-factist about things, which I like a lot when he spoke. He was not hiding. Now, what do you mean? No, I was, my family was okay. I did it for the money, which is great.
I didn't need money. No, I was rich.
He was not rich. I mean, he was okay, though. And anyway, Podolsky is very little known, and it'd be nice if to read about him, because Rosen is known because of Einstein-Rosen bridges and working relativity with Einstein, but Podolsky is less known. Anyway, the argument kind of goes as follows. The paper is old, so if you read the original paper, you realize that, man, we've gone a long way since then. But you can tell at the time how things were. Basically, proposing the paper is very unassuming. The paper just points out that there is a conflict, or in principle conflict, with relativity and quantum mechanics, in the sense that if you consider entangled states and you measure one subsystem, right, under the Copenhagen way of seeing things, there were two possible things that could happen, right? Two possible consequences. Consequence one is either there's some spooky action at a distance. They call it spooky, meaning that, well, if you think that collapse is a thing that updates the state of the wave function, then I measure here and then affect somebody far away. That is a spooky action. We call a spooky action. Or quantum mechanics is not a complete description of what's going on. Meaning that with quantum mechanics, I'm a statistical mechanics, is just describing your ignorance about a set of things that are behind it, that are the true theory, if you want, the microscopic theory, that is set by some variable. So the outcome of the measurement should be fixed in advance. All that you're doing by measuring one is like the same as you do a classical correlation. You're gaining knowledge about those variables that were set, but your ignorance makes it probabilistic. Those are the two options that they contemplate, right?
That means A of lambda is equal to...
Not yet. We haven't gotten there yet. Okay. I will read that and then we'll see that, okay? So this is work that I did in advance for saving time. Anyway, so the two possible options are for them, those, right? Either there's a spooky action at a distance. When you measure the first, you collapse the whole system. Or rather, when you measure the first, you're gaining information about the real microscopic things that are there that are the ones that tell you that the value was of what you're going to measure emerges out of the microscopics. So it was already set in a way. Make sense? Okay, so an advanced question. Which one was right? The Copenhagen's or Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen?
Neither.
That's the right answer. They were none of them. So if I have to answer which one was more correct, I would say Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen, by far. The Copenhagen's were not correct. The Copenhagen's assigned a value of reality to the notion of collapse of the wave function that we know is a thing that is not real. It's a convenient fiction that we use because it's effective calculations that work for some cases, right? And that's why we use it. Collapse of the wave function is not a thing. And if somebody wants to fight me, I'm here. Yeah.
In quantum foundation courses, I think we learned that the Copernican interpretation actually tells us that quantum mechanics is not a good theory for the real.
It's not a what?
It's not a good theory for describing the real inequality.
I'm not going to interfere with the foundations of quantum mechanics course, but I don't understand the statement. What does that mean? Why? Why not?
Because it just there's no statement about what is the real.
Well, it depends. If you hear Bohr talk, sometimes it feels like there is. I don't know. Again, fine. I have no objection with that. The Copenhagen interpretation assumes some things that we're calling interpretation, but they're later on non-interpretation. For example, collapse of the wave function being one of them as a physical mechanism of some kind. They do not enter to tell you, maybe that's what they mean, how it collapses microscopically, but they assume collapse happens. Maybe they don't tell you about what's going on in microscopics, but they assume it's a thing. So if you ask Bohr or Schrödinger, they would probably tell you, I mean, I don't know, they're not here to defend themselves, but they would probably tell you that, yeah, you are when you measure the first, you are projecting, and you are collapsing. If you get a one, you're projecting over the right angle, and you collapse the wave function. That is the Copenhagen take. All right? And Stepanovsky and Rosen discussed this to the, well, Einstein in the Solvay conference, discussed this to the death. Almost like he didn't like quantum mechanics because of this stuff. Now, Einstein was defending the notion of locality because the notion of locality is very important in physics. It's a notion that, if you violate locality with a theory, you better have a good reason. Huh? This is something that you may have seen in many places. If a theory is not local, whoa. I mean, again, I don't know. Maybe the real theory of what's going on is not local. We don't know that because maybe our notion of locality is emergent from the real theory. I don't know. There are some proposals for quantum gravity that are definitely not local. But then again, you would observe some scale violations of locality that we haven't seen yet. We have no evidence. Our best, for example, even the kind of locality that we see, which is based on the Poincaré group, more or less, I mean, approximately Poincaré group, even from cosmology, observation from cosmology, I used to have a slide on that. As of 2008, our best measurements of Lorentz violations give really, really, really little room for Lorentz invariant violations, right? Poincaré invariant violations. And the room is in the high energies, in the really, really high energies, meaning that so far we haven't seen any evidence. So far, we've seen evidence that our current models are not complete. We know that our current models for description of gravity are not good, because we know they're not self-consistent in a way. They predict things that cannot be physical. We know that black holes cannot be described with our current models, for example, whatever's going on there, of combining the standard model with relativity. We know that cosmology is full of inconsistencies that cannot be explained with our standard models. We know there's something missing. We don't know what's missing. We don't have any evidence that what's missing is quantum gravity. We just believe that because of all the fundamental interactions that meet a quantum description, gravity would too, right? That's, it seems reasonable. But we have no idea of what's going on. We just know that our models currently are not complete, right? In the sense, or are not good descriptions of what's going on. But the notion of locality, we have found no counterexample. In fact, we haven't found any counterexample to general relativity yet. General relativity nails everything so far that we've seen, that we've been able to see. In fact, we feel that we're missing, perhaps, you know, expansion of the universe and cosmological constant is the most open, glaring evidence that there's something incomplete, but people, that could be ascribed to our description of matter, or our description of gravity, or both. So we don't know yet. Anyway, the point being that locality is a very sacred principle of physics. In fact, QFT is a local theory. QFT was built because we needed a local theory. Well, I mean, I don't know. QFT was built by physicists trying to predict things, not paying much attention to those things, actually. But when people axiomatize quantum field theory, when trying to do it right, the theory was built on the principles that we need to do quantum mechanics, and the theory has to be local. In this case in particular, relativistically local. So imposing relativity together with quantum mechanics is what leads to QFT as a theory. Getting the axioms of quantum mechanics and reinforcing them with axioms of locality and a couple more for representation of those objects. That's what QFT is, right? So, yeah, go ahead.
Would you say the path integral is local?
The path integral is not a thing, it's just a technique, right? So a quantum field theory, that is a good quantum field theory, is local, yes. Certain, very local. There are axioms that it has to satisfy, and one of them is a couple of actions, something called Einstein locality, which reflects as microcausality, which is observables of a QFT that are in regions, defined in regions that are space-like separated, have to commute. That's the imposition of locality on the theory. Make sense? That makes it immediate that you cannot gain any information about one when measuring the other. Make sense? But again, this is an imposition. This is an imposition on a quantum theory to make it local. The notion of locality, I want to transmit that the notion of locality is very sacred from foundational point of view. Violating locality would be tough. Would be tough. And we will see, because we're going to see an example of what it means, right? Make sense, everybody? So, those discussions and the Copenhagen discussions and so on led to, in the current times, to use the word locality meaning different things. Which is kind of sad when we do quantum mechanics, because people say, oh yeah, an EPR pair is not local. What do you mean by that? It's not separable? Sure. Is that it's the same as not? So you see, the notion of quantum locality, what people use in quantum mechanics as calling locality, is different from what we use in the rest of physics and call locality, right? We're going to be a bit more precise about what we mean with locality. Okay? That clear? The precedent is clear, more or less? Why are we looking into this? All right. So, for a long, long time, this discussion was considered philosophy. The reason being that nobody thought there would be an experiment that would decide between a hidden variable proposal, like Einstein suggests. Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen in the paper don't say that that's what they think will happen. They just say that it feels easier to admit that rather than violating locality, in a way. A question?
Yeah, just very quick question. when we talk about locality, it's always about locality of action and effects between observables. But do we also require that hidden variables affect everything like locally, maybe like?
We'll talk about it, yeah. Hidden variables, you can think of shared preparation. We will talk about these hidden variables a little bit. There's something called non-local hidden variables, but that's a different story. Are my hidden variables here are going to be what we call local hidden variables? But
it's not as sacred as you said. Like locality of hidden variables is not as.
It is sacred to me.
Okay.
There are people doing something else. That. Yeah. I don't know. Again, some people use non-local hidden variables to describe quantum mechanics in an equivalent way. For me, it's a mathematical way of doing it. It doesn't have value of physical reality for me. Because locality for me is important. Make sense? Anyway, we can discuss that after we see the example to see what that means. All right, so for a long time, this was considered philosophy. Meaning, like, nobody thought, okay, there could be an experiment, let alone a simple experiment, that can discern whether we have a local hidden variable theory, so quantum mechanics is not complete. There's something else that quantum mechanics emerges from. Or something classical in the sense of the uncertainty doesn't exist if you actually know everything. Or if quantum mechanics was just spooky like that, in the sense that, that's not me, right? Okay. Spooky in the sense of if you measure one, you may be affecting the other, or whatever is happening, that's what thought out for a long time to be outside of the realm of what you can prove with an experiment. There was a philosopher of physics called Bell that did many things, like, for example, the Bell paradox in relativity, or this in quantum mechanics. There was a philosopher of physics, like, anyway, by the way, like, the person who proved that you cannot do relativistic quantum mechanics, the person who proved that relativistic quantum mechanics is very wrong, it's incompatible, the assumptions that you make in relativistic quantum mechanics are mutually exclusive, that's Malament, David Malament. He also was a philosopher, or he's still alive, a philosopher of physics. So just telling you that philosophers of physics working in foundations are typically closer to a pure mathematician than they are to the average physicist, okay? Mm-hmm. So just to know that they know their stuff very well. So there was a philosopher of physics called Bell that came up with a simple experiment that can actually discern if quantum mechanics is a hidden variable theory, or rather, it can discern if it's a theory that has local realism. It's a local realistic theory. We will discuss what that means, okay? Because those are two separate notions, the notion of locality, the notion of realism, all right? So let's see a version of what Bill did. Consider two binary systems, and by binary is that the observables have two values only, just to simplify. In our case, plus or minus one, okay? And a pair of instruments that can measure each system. Now, when I mean instruments, I mean labs, okay? So everything surrounding the measurement, all right? Something, all the things controllable about the measurement. Right, for system A, we denote the settings of the measurement as small a, and for system B, we denote the settings of the measurements as small b. This is calligraphic A, and B are the names of the systems, okay? So now let's assume that the outcome for measurements could also depend, in principle, on a number of unknown, uncontrollable hidden variables, lambda, that may be common to both of them, or maybe not be common to both of them. So I'm not assuming anything. Both of them could be, lambda could be, right. There is some electromagnetic field that permeates the two, right? And then the electromagnetic field at the beginning of the first experiment and at the end of the second, between that, it transmitted information. It could be variables that are necessary to explain the outcomes, all right? Make sense? That it could depend on. That are not controllable, that I don't see, that I'm ignorant about. Make sense? All right. Now, we say that the result of a measurement on A, that we denote with capital A, non-calligraphic, will be a function of the settings of the lab in A and possibly the hidden variables. Yep?
Should we assume that the hidden variables are exactly the same? Between A and B.
Some of them for here. I mean, if they're not the same, then I don't care because they can affect the experiment, both outcomes of the experiment.
Okay.
But I'm saying that there's at least some of them that may affect the both experiments. Mm. This is a particular case of this is they don't, if you want. Make sense? All right? So we are if we say this only, that's the assumption of realism. If all that we need is the system A and the controllable settings, that's the notion of realism. Like, my description of the system is complete. I don't need anything else. Make sense? If I say, perhaps there's something I don't know that is affecting my experiment, that is, well, the theory is not realistic in the sense that it's not describing the elements of physical reality. There's something else. Make sense? I'm simplifying a lot. I mean, in philosophy, there's nuance with every statement that I said, a lot of. But I'm hoping that it transmits the idea a little bit. And the notion of locality is precisely this that I write here, that the measurement of A cannot depend on the choices of setups in lab B. And same for B. The outcome of an experiment on B cannot depend on the settings of lab A. Make sense? But in general, you could have said that A could be a function of A, B, and lambda, B could be a function of A, B, and lambda, so we can say locality. What do I mean by locality? I mean that A, that in principle could depend on A and B and lambda, is actually a function of only A and lambda. And same for B, right? That in principle could depend on A, B, and lambda, is actually a function of B and lambda. That's what we call locality here. All right? And the notion of realism is that A and B, if you want, right, A and B could depend on a set of hidden variables. Part that I call realism here is the dependence on those hidden variables. There's something real behind it, some microstates that set up the state of measurements. Make sense? All right. So the notion of locality, the fact that A and B, the outcomes of measurements of A can depend only on A and not on B, it's very important in physics. It's telling me that if I do an experiment in Brisbane, Australia, and I do an experiment here, the setup they choose in the lab will have no effect on me. Does that make sense? That's very important. It's important before thinking relativity, because it's very difficult to accept that somebody really far away doing an experiment, their choices of setup is going to affect my measurements. That feels weird. When you put in relativity, that feels even more weird, because you can have the two labs space-like separated. And therefore, if relativity is correct, which it is to the levels of energy in which you're doing this experiment, you cannot really affect at all, transmit any information from lab A to lab B. Make sense? So if you put the two labs in space-like separation, in relativity, this notion is just enforcing relativistic locality. Make sense? Is that understood?
But the hidden variable lambda is time-like separated from both A.
It could be a common origin. It could be whatever. Yeah, lambda is not representing here. It could represent the things that are as any speed that you want. But you could think of it, well, the two labs were fabricated at some point, and because of that, they share a common origin. And there's an electric field in the past that is the same for both. Think whatever you want like that. Extra variables that you cannot control. They are not in your theory, if you want. Make sense? In your description of the experiment. Things that you cannot see, things that you cannot control. Small A and B, things that you have some dials that you can dial in and you can control. The settings of the lab, the settings of the experiment. Does that make sense? All right. All right, so let's set it up. So let's study. The correlations between outcomes of measurements, or between outcomes rather, on A and B. All right. So let me compute the correlator. So I have the correlator that will depend on A and B. All right, so what I'm assuming is the following. That's going to be, let me write first, B lambda, A lambda, B lambda, where, of course, a lambda could be plus or minus one. Those are the possible outcomes. B, b lambda could be plus or minus one. And I didn't write the lambda. Sorry, I should have written this first. Capital lambda of lambda a lambda b lambda, and this capital lambda of lambda is just a probability distribution satisfies that. All right. So what I'm saying here is that the correlation functions, of course, are the product of the measurements, right? And of course, I'm assuming that lambda I have no access to. So in general, it could be probabilistic. It could be a probability, like in statistical mechanics. There could be a probability distribution over lambda, right, that I don't know, and I need to sum over. So I'm weighting the configurations with the probability that they happen. Make sense? Some people ask sometimes, oh, so lambda has to be a probability distribution. So, yeah, it cannot be a fixed amount. Yeah, sure, that's the case, but it's a delta, right, this probability distribution. If it's a delta, for sure. You know for sure that the correlation function is just the product of these two for one particular choice of lambda. So it's not. It's more general than saying that there's a set of hidden variables that have a set value, if you want. I'm allowing these hidden variables to be probabilistic as well. Make sense? So this is the correlation function between the two measurements on A and B. And it depends only on A and B because I've integrated for all possible values of lambda of the hidden variables. Make sense?
Sorry. I'm gonna go back on the last part. You said realism means that A and B could depend on a set of hidden variables.
Yeah.
Why is it called realism?
A and B is mole. So the outcome of the measurement, I call it capital. Yeah.
Why is it called realism?
Oh, because there's some real variables that exist there that would explain your experiment. You're assuming that there's something behind your theory that has a definite value that if you knew it, you could predict the experiment.
Oh, okay.
Make sense? You can't because you don't know. So your experiment is probabilistic, you see?
Right.
Make sense, everybody? All right. So if there's, so basically it's telling you, right, there's something real behind that has definite values. That's what we call that.
Why not determinism? Like, is that a different thing?
It's different, yeah. Because statistical mechanics theory is realistic, but it's also non-deterministic.
Oh.
See what I mean?
Okay.
Realistic means that there are definite values for some variables that you may not have access to it.
Right.
And your theory is probabilistic instead of deterministic because of ignorance, and only because of ignorance. There are elements of physical reality behind the microscopics that you can have access to, but you maybe don't have yet.
Mm-hmm.
Make sense?
It says that every real thing should be classical.
Ah, that is a bit stronger, no? What do you mean by classical? So here, this is agnostic about quantum or classical. What do you mean by quantum or classical here? We're talking experiments and outcome of experiments. Definition of classical, then maybe I agree. What do you call classical?
Probabilistic theory.
What's that?
Classical probabilistic theory, I guess.
But what is the definition? You are right, but what is your definition of classical? See, those words are loaded.
Yeah, so, I mean, I don't know, like, can we say realism?
What, sorry?
I feel like realism is kind of more stronger statement than
what?
Classical.
Well, it's talking about the fact that you have microscopics with definite values. Yes, that's what I mean. By the way, in quantum mechanics, you can have things with definite values of some observables, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So again, calling something classical or quantum is a bit loaded, always. I need to ask, what do you mean by classical? What do you mean by quantum? There's some clear things, right? If you're describing a system or the state of a system as a distribution over a phase space, and that is a probability distribution, I would call that classical. If it's not a probability distribution, I would say, oh, that's non-classical. And maybe if it's a particular kind of non-probability distribution, I would call it quantum. So it's not trivial. Quantum, something is quantum when you've gone through a quantization map of phase space. So how quantum manifests is a different story. So when you tell me about being classical or quantum, you need to tell me what you mean by classical here. But yeah, it's some variables that have a definite value. You have a probability distribution because of ignorance, but I'm assuming that it's a set of variables that have a definite value that are knowable in principle, but you don't know them. That makes sense? That's what I call realism here. Is that clear, I guess, I hope? Maybe you want to think of it as being classical, fine. But you need to tell me what you mean by classical. As in, they have a definite value, for sure. It's, but you may not know it. Make sense, everybody? Alrighty. So, we have the correlator, and we're going to focus on the difference between two correlators. By the way, correlators are measurable. You can repeat this experiment many times and get the outcomes and multiply them and compute the correlators, taking averages in that. Okay? All right. So I'm going to compute the difference between two correlators in which I do the experiment with settings A and B, and then we set this A and B prime. Okay? So if I compute that difference, this is, of course, A lambda, B lambda.
Can't the probability distribution change over time, or?
Time could be one of your hidden variables if you want.
Okay.
Sir, it can depend on time. I really don't care. This is, again, everything that could affect the experiment, so I really don't care about dynamics pictures in here. All right. A lambda B B prime lambda. Okay. All right. Now the next thing I'm gonna do, I'm gonna do a little trick, which is doing nothing to it by adding and subtracting the same thing. Okay. So I have. Is it going to fit? Probably it's going to fit to this line. It's equal to integral d lambda lambda. Okay. Multiplied. A lambda B lambda multiplied. 1 plus minus A prime lambda B prime lambda minus, range over the whole thing, so maybe I should make this parenthesis bigger so it's obvious. A lambda B prime lambda multiplying 1 plus minus A prime lambda B lambda. All right, and close this parenthesis. All right. That's correct. Let me make sure I make typos. Prime B and A B prime. Perfect.
We're having A prime now.
A B. Hold on. A B lambda. Oh, because I added something and I subtracted it. So if you expand the whole product, it's the same thing.
Oh.
I did nothing to it.
Right. Okay. Thanks. Yeah.
And in particular, I put it in the formal because I really want to have an A prime. So what I added has an A prime.
Uh-huh.
Make sense? The same expression, just expand the product and they combine and things that are not in here cancel. Make sense?
Wait, when you have that there, you have an A prime lambda and a B prime lambda, but there you have A prime lambda and just B lambda.
Yeah,
okay.
This will cancel.
So you cancel?
Yeah, just do it, expand it.
There's
a minus sign here.
Okay.
That's right. This is, again, this is not, it's not a genius trick or anything. It's like, what do I want? I really want to have two different settings for A as well. Let me introduce it. And I introduce it by subtract, adding and subtract the same thing. Trick as old as math, right? Euler did these things already to solve differential equations when he didn't have rigorous math. When he solved the linear equations, when you have that... that the space of solutions is the generator, again, value is the generator, right? Then Euler said, how do I find an independent solution now? And I said, oh yeah, let me add or subtract something. And it's not really cool there. So it's very old, this district. Put there what you want to consider by adding and subtracting it. There are two tricks that are very good. One is doing nothing by adding and subtracting and doing nothing by inserting the identity. Those are things that are present everywhere. Make sense? All right, cool. So, since A, the absolute value of A and the absolute value of B is always less or equal than 1, we can have the following bound. The absolute value of C, AB, minus C, A, B prime, is going to be less or equal than integral d lambda. Lambda multiplied 1 plus minus A. A prime lambda B. B prime lambda. All right, and I would put this, yeah, that's fine. Plus, yeah, 1 plus minus A. A prime lambda B, B prime lambda, no, sorry, B lambda. All right. All right, so I've used that. Right, no, that's fine, yeah. Let me see that I didn't commit mistakes. Yeah, perfect. All right, so all that I'm saying is that, well, I know that these things, in the best case scenario, these things are going to be 1, this thing is going to be 1, so I'm going to get the sum of, what's that?
A lambda and times BB prime lambda is 1, and also AA lambda BB lambda?
No, it would be minus 1. So in that case, it's the sum. So I'm taking the worst case scenario, where this is 1 and this is minus 1. That's why I'm writing less or equal. Make sense?
Wait, no.
Maybe let me write this.
Oh, yeah.
OK. And then taking something that certainly bounds it from above. Make sense?
Wait. Which ones are you plugging in the ones or the minus ones to?
I'm making this term plus this term's 1.
The whole term? That whole
yeah.
Term?
And this one.
BB lambda is equal to 1.
That's right, okay. Exactly.
And AA lambda BB prime lambda is equal to minus 1.
That's right.
So then it would be like a bigger number then. And since A and B are all less than 1, those things in the brackets are always positive.
That's right, exactly. Or 0, but yes.
Yeah.
It doesn't change sign. It's not going to be a subtraction ever. Make sense?
But it's a plus or a minus.
No. Here, I don't care, because at most this is going to be 0 in the worst case scenario. Never invert sign.
Okay.
So it's still true that it's less or equal.
Okay.
Make sense, everybody? It's the most difficult step of the whole derivation. The rest is mechanical now.
Well, you're subtracting them, so they're, neither of them are just going to be negative when you're subtracting them. But
No, hold on. Yeah, exactly. So I'm taking, say, the worst case scenario, or the worst case meaning, like, make this the largest possible. This make it 1. This make it minus 1.
Oh.
So it's a sum of 2.
The whole thing positive.
Yeah.
And
this, at most, is going to be 0 or larger.
Oh, okay. So the biggest possible value, you can make it so that...
Not the biggest, but it's certainly the real value is below that. I didn't need it to be the biggest.
Okay.
Make sense?
Yeah.
Or if you want to convince yourself better, think of combinations. These things can only be minus one or one out of them. Think of a combination that you do here that would violate that bound, and you'll find none. You can do it brute force, right? Mm-hmm. I can try. Make this plus one, base plus one. This plus, you know, you can brute force it and check that there's no way to get below that bound. But it kind of makes sense, right? I hope.
Yeah.
This is the most difficult stuff. Difficult as in accepting. Now we can use the fact that lambda is a probability distribution, so it integrates to one. So these terms are one and one when you integrate them over lambda. And we obtain that this is equal to twice two. That two comes from that and that. And then I have two correlation functions, right? I have the correlation function plus minus and the correlation function C A prime B prime plus C A prime B. Agreed?
Minus.
What's that?
Plus minus.
Plus minus, yeah. Because of this plus minus.
Second one too.
Oh, no, no, no. Plus minus. Yeah, yes, yes, yes. What I mean is I didn't want to write it. No, you are completely right. I thought I wanted to write a parenthesis. In my mind, there was a parenthesis. Sorry. Thank you. That makes sense, everybody?
Yeah.
All right. Now, this, what we found is that this is less or equal than that. So we can write now, we can take absolute. Keep in mind also the correlation functions can only be 1 or minus 1 because they are the product of 1 and minus 1, right? So let's go to the worst case scenario. That's why I have plus minus. Sometimes minus, sometimes plus. But let's summarize the worst case scenario. Oh, by worst case, I mean where this is the largest. Well, rather, let me just write it. I'm going to see. Minus C A B prime plus C A prime B prime plus C A prime B is less or equal than 2. All right, so I put this on the other side. I took absolute values of it. And I said, well, what it's going to do is, or maybe on this side. You can put absolute values in here. Okay? And check what is the worst case scenario. What would make this the largest, right? And that's the combination that makes it the largest. Make sense, everybody? Again, that's why I wanted to write a parenthesis rather than a plus minus. It's more convenient to see that. Okay. So by manipulating the correlation functions, we arrive to an expression that tells me that this particular combination of correlation functions will always be less or equal than 2. Make sense? And what are the two assumptions? My assumptions are pretty general. Only made 2. My assumptions are that My assumption is locality, meaning that A cannot depend on small b. The outcome of the measurement on A cannot depend on the settings of lab B. And the outcome of the measurement on B cannot depend on the setting of lab A. And I also assumed that perhaps there's a set of hidden variables shared between the two. Make sense? That are unknowable. Or unknown, rather. All right, so now what is left is to see, so any theory that is local realistic has to satisfy this. Yeah?
I want to go back to my previous question. You're assuming locality for A and B, like A and B cannot affect each other, but nowhere in this proof you're assuming that hidden variables should affect A and B locally. They can affect A and B non-local in a non-local way as well.
So what he's saying...
You don't know how they affect
So in a way it's more general than assuming that they're local, right? But the locality assumption is only about the things that you can see. I don't care about what I can't see, right? Make sense?
So we can construct a non-local theory that has some hidden variables that affect everything non-locally, like some field.
As long as you tell me that those are not real, then fine.
As as long as you cannot observe them.
That's right. No, by no real, sorry. As long as you tell me that you cannot observe them, I'm fine with that, yeah, for sure. But then again, you can also not. If you want, you can restrict it more. I'm just being very generous with the hidden variables. And letting the hidden variables be super powerful. That makes sense? That makes sense? So again, it could be local, it could be not, and I don't care. Because I'm going to prove that one of these two things are wrong. So, okay? Or at least wrong, that quantum mechanics experiments, if you do an experiment that quantum mechanics predicts and you do it and you find that this is violated, then whatever theory it is, quantum mechanics or not, is going to violate local realism. Make sense? This is about experiments. Huh? No experiment should be able to violate this under the assumption of local realism. Make sense? All right, now let's do an experiment in quantum mechanics. I brought my optical sensors here and my parametric crystal here. So we're going to do it by using quantum mechanics to predict the experiment, but knowing that the predictions of quantum mechanics match what people do in the lab, right? What is important here is seeing if a real experiment violates that or not. But I'm going to use quantum mechanics. We're going to see that quantum mechanics would violate this, at least on settings in quantum mechanics. But that doesn't mean that reality is non-local realistic. You would have to go to the experiment to check. That would mean that quantum mechanics is not. Now, quantum mechanics fails to explain the experiment, then, you know, that's a different story. The point here is seeing this in the lab. This is important. All right? The fact that quantum mechanics violates that just tells you an experiment that would distinguish the two theories, a local realistic theory from quantum mechanics. Make sense? Anyway, let's set up the following. So, psi minus. I'm not going to do the I'm going to leave the algebra, or the arithmetics rather, to you. Which entangled state am I going to put there? I'm going to do psi minus. Let's consider that A and B are described within quantum mechanics as the state of A and B. All right, this is important. The state of A and B is described within quantum mechanics as the entangled state. I'm going to call it psi minus A and B. And this is going to be 1 over root 2, 0 A, 1 B, plus 1 A, 0 B. You could choose any maximally entangled state for this. I choose that one, so I will tailor the measurements to that one, okay? All right, so now, think that this is, for example, a Stenger-Lach experiment, right? It could be a Stenger-Lach. So the two setups that you have is where to place the angle where you place your Stenger-Lach, right? What observable you're measuring, in terms of what observables in the set of observables that you can measure for spin 1/2, which is the sigma matrices, all right? The Pauli matrices, Pauli operators. I'm going to choose some combinations that in practice would correspond to different angles of your Stenger-Lach configuration. Make sense? All right.
Sorry, is that a psi minus or is that?
Psi minus, yeah. It's notation. The Bell states are called, you have seen that probably somewhere, no? Phi plus minus, psi plus minus. All right, so let's see that, for example, Alice and Bob, let's see, Alice can choose between two detector settings. A is going to be measure spin in the x-axis. Say that there's a common shared frame. They talked in advance and they made sure that they share a frame. It's a non-trivial step. They have synchronized their labs. They know what they call in the x-direction and the y-direction and the z-direction in both labs. Okay. Spin in the x-axis. And A prime where is A, I actually call the set axis, sorry, an A prime measure spin in the set axis. X. Sorry. I do this a lot. I'm so sorry. All right, Bob. Same thing. I'm going to call B for Bob. It's going to be B is going to be measure spin in the set prime axis. Or I shouldn't call it prime, which is, I mean, in a, what should I call it? In the, I'm going to just say an angle. So the frame, basically the frame of B is going to be rotated 3 pi over 4. That's what I want to do. All right, so you have Alice. The X and the Z axis, if you want. So Alice makes measurements here and here. That's for Alice. And Bob is going to make measurements, something like, it's going to be the combination, so the plus direction, so this one, and this one. That's going to be, if you want, the Z for Bob and the X for Bob. So I'm going to write the observable, rather. Measures. One root two identity for Alice tensor sigma z plus sigma x. All right, that's the observable. Instead of being sigma z, I rotate it a little bit, 45 degrees. And B prime is measure 1 over root 2 identity for Alice tensor sigma z minus sigma x. All right, so I'm going to just write it here. A, the observable measure, A that depends only on A, is sigma z tensor identity for B. A at A prime is going to be sigma x. Sigma x identity for B. And the observable B hat B, all right, is going to be minus 1 root 2. Because I think that's 3. Sorry, it's not 45 degrees, it's all the way. It's the same thing, effectively, but with a sign of difference. Minus 1 over root 2. Identity for Alice, tensor, sigma z plus sigma x. And B prime, or the observable, that Bob would measure for the second setting, it is a minus, let me put it here clearly, is 1 over root 2. Identity for Alice, tensor, sigma z, minus sigma x. Just again, it's a very simple setup of a Stenger-Black-like experiment, measuring spin in different directions. Make sense? Something that you could do in the lab, very easily. All right.
Why the minus?
Because of the state I picked, yeah. The minus sign because I'm rotating the axis 3 pi over 4. Again, it's my choice.
3 pi over 4.
Yeah. Make sense?
That's
right. Again, I just pick the observables to match the state that I have so I can get a violation of them, obviously. Make sense? All right. So let's compute the different correlators that we need here. A, B. So this is very easy to compute, right? I don't know if we should do one or you can do it on your own. What do you think, given the time? it takes a while to compute, right? You have to put the state, you have to sandwich this with the state. You have to compute, so let's compute that one. How about that? Okay, we compute that one. So that's the expectation of A of A, B of B. So we have on the sigma set for Alice, and then minus 1 over root 2 here, and then tensor with sigma set for Bob, let's say Alice here, let's say Bob here, or Bob. All right. And now you need to put the state in it. So we have the states that I have is 0, 1,
0, Alice, and I'm going to have
it is a
product. I can do it very easily.
That's going to be 0, Alice. Alice. Okay, and this is going to be let's just do the whole thing. 0A, 1B, plus, we have another root 2, so minus 1 over 2, 0A, 1B. And I have sigma A Z tensor sigma B Z plus sigma X B 0, 1 plus I'm going to have now the 0, 1, 0, 1. Same operator, sigma z tensor sigma b, sigma z b plus sigma x b. And now I have the other one, 1, 0. Okay. Then I'm going to have, you can tell already, well, some of them will. You can tell already that if there's non-diagonal elements, the sigma set 1 is going to be 0. So this one has diagonal elements on A, so that's fine. This one has diagonal elements on, it doesn't have diagonal elements on A, so this is going to be 0. All right, I don't write the other one because it's also going to be 0. This and its conjugate, this is the one where you solve the Brandt-Leggett, are also going to be 0. Then finally you get 1A0B and the same operator sigma z tensor sigma z b plus sigma x b 1A0B. All right, and this is all that there is because again, there's another term like this that is 0. You can tell this
because the convention I'm using for this is the sigma
set.
The 0 has negative eigenvalue. Okay. So this is 1 half.
And this one is. So. The other 1 half. It's also the
diagonal.
So it's either sigma. You sum the whole thing.
You get
1 over root 2. Acting on 0. Why are you surprised for
that one?
I'm going
to
use the information.
I'm going to use the other one. This is
use that one.
I don't care. Maybe I shouldn't do the calculation. All right. And I'll tell you the result. But this one surprises you.
Because they're building quantum info.
And indeed, when this topic is quantum info, I'm going to use this one. Makes more sense when you're thinking of a state of a
level system.
State,
deal with state. So you put have a, if you want,
the lowest energy,
divided by 2.
The lowest energy
is the zero. That's why we use that often in relativistic.
I know you may not like it, so I'm not going to use it for the rest of quantum mechanics.
But for this
example in my notes, I didn't use
it. So. Anyway. Root 2
for this one
gives you okay. I'm gonna
give you the result. Do it at home and we
start computing this one in the beginning.
Yes. So, but you can tell already that it's gonna be 1 root 2. It's gonna be 1 root 2. We can write the final
question that I'm going to write today, and then a bit of conclusion.
B minus A B plus A
prime. Thing is, so
what you get in the end is actually makes sense, everybody. And this thing is obviously larger. So when you look at the correlation function that you get in quantum
mechanics
with a prediction for a single black
experiment
with an entangled state like that,
you are
violating the inequality that we have.
I don't want
to spend time on that. You know what I'm going to do the next day? I'm going to
program it in mathematics. Qualities. I require. Imagine that they're not.